not fade away. A love is love and not fade away.
Going back to February 3rd, 1959. You're listening to WMFO in Medford, Massachusetts. My name is Chris Earle. The show is Time Travel 2.0. And here is the first guest of Time Travel 2.0. It's Edward Buchard.
Whoa! Thanks for having me on, Chris.
Yeah, thanks for coming back and settling in here again Friday night on WMFO in Medford. Usually here from 8 to 10 p.m. every Friday night, correct?
Yes, alternating between plastic sushi strawberries and time sound collages and Tears of the Gods sound collages.
And what do you got set up for us tonight?
Tonight, February is Black History Month, and we're going to be celebrating that with a quintuple feature lineup of black musicians. Willie Dixon, who was born in 1915, and he wrote hundreds of songs, and he had a profound influence on not just rhythm and blues, but on rock and roll and all the things that that came after, like heavy metal.
Right.
And then we're also going to be hearing from Jimi Hendrix, a bunch of deep cuts.
Beautiful.
Yeah, no Purple Haze.
No.
And then another one of our featured artists is Miles Davis. And then for my ambiance, the music that I play when I'm talking during the breaks, it's all going to be the jazz musician Sun Ra and his orchestra.
Sure, nice.
And Sun Ra had this kind of idea that he was actually a being from outer space, from Saturn, and that kind of permeates a lot of his music.
Interesting.
And then the audio clips from who knows where mixed on top of the music are going to be from my favorite Black American freedom fighter, Malcolm X,
mm-hmm.
a 1964 speech that he was given to, yes, and it's... And it's a great speech, so that'll be mixed on top of some Miles Davis music.
Nice. I saw Malcolm X is on HBO Max, I believe, the Spike Lee movie from 1992. If anybody wants to go out there and see it, it is out there, and one of Spike Lee's best movies, I think.
I've got to check that out. Thanks for mentioning that, Chris.
Yeah.
It's
a great movie. You gotta settle in because it's one of those ones that's an epic. So it's over 3 hours, I believe. And but it's a good movie.
An epic, yeah, an epic.
Yep.
So I thought you had a fascinating conversation going before with JC.
JC, yes, yeah. His name is Jim, and his last name begins with a C. So we always call him JC.
Very good. Yeah. Yep. And that thought about time traveling, I love the idea of time traveling. And as we has discussed on some past shows here,
mm-hmm.
My own personal experience with having a wonderful bound set of Life magazines from 1950 to 1969,
right.
Originally from the Boston Public Library, and just picking one of those up. And flipping through it, reading the stories and seeing the advertisements.
All brings you right back.
To 1953 or 1968, any of those. But I also think that notion of actually being able to go back in time and change things is just so fraught with peril.
It is. One of the things that I love about Groundhog Day is... And I was explaining, did you see the Bill Murray movie, the Groundhog Day movie at all?
I didn't, but when you mentioned you were having it as an important part of your show tonight, I looked at the Wikipedia articles, and I've got the idea. It sounds like a cool movie.
So he basically is stuck in Groundhog Day for, if not a spoiler, but for a long time. So he's stuck on Groundhog Day for a number of years and years and years. And he starts with, I can eat whatever I want and I won't gain any weight.
Yep.
I can steal. I can get other people to like me. I can go to the bank and rob the bank. So he starts with all of these chaotic things, and then he starts doing all these good things because he realizes he's stuck there and he has to take care of the town.
Mm.
He goes so far as to try to get rid of the groundhog to end the curse, but that doesn't work either. So he gets caught in this infinite loop and gets
every
stuck
day
in the
he
same...
wakes up and it's the February 3rd again.
Yes, it's February 2nd again.
February 2nd, yeah.
And he wakes up to Sonny and Cher, I Got You, Babe, at the start of the alarm clock at, I believe it's around 6 a.m. like every day.
Mm.
And it's a great movie. It's a great comedy, and it's also... it's also one of those movies that has a feel-good ending because he does the right thing.
The right thing.
Yeah, and he goes out of his way to save people along the way that normally wouldn't have been saved on Groundhog Day. And he makes the world a better place.
I understand from reading the Wikipedia article that there was quite a lot of going back and forth on the original script. That was developed by one writer, and then when it was originally picked, and it went through many drafts that he did,
mm-hmm.
and then as it became closer to being produced, the Hollywood executives wanted changes to make it a more commercially successful movie. And there was a lot of angst about that, and I believe maybe it was the director, he had a big role in it. And then Bill Murray, when he got signed up onto the project, he started getting involved with that. And it's maybe something like the Fleetwood Mac Rumors album, where it's a perfect album, in my opinion. But if you understand and you the history of what was going on, it was just absolutely crazy because the band weren't talking to each other. They hated each other.
Yep.
And it's incredible that it ended up being so perfect and such a great result despite all of that.
Yeah, I think a lot of that when it comes to like art, you know, you have to have a little bit of conflict in there in order, especially if people are passionate about something, they bring their own passions in. And of course, you know, they're going to do, there's going to be some tug and pull with everything. And a lot of people wouldn't give in, you know, and compromise. One of the reasons the Police were a great band is because there was that conflict between Stewart and Sting all the time. And Andy was kind of the middleman.
I've read about that because I've read interviews with all of them. Mm-hmm. And then I think another band that pulled that off pretty well was Queen.
Queen's a great band, yeah.
They would have big creative fights about things. Mm-hmm. And they had a pretty good structure, too, because each one of them were talented enough songwriters. And they eventually came up with some formula where, the guitar player Brian May and Freddie Mercury might have four songs on each album.
Right.
And then the bass player and the drummer might have three or something like that. They worked out what that was. Because,
right.
Okay, we won't go and fight about whose songs everybody's allowed a certain number.
Mm-hmm.
And I think another thing that they did that other musicians and other bands didn't is once they got through their fight, everybody went through and was very professional, and they did their best. And there's some other bands, like I know with Fleetwood Mac, there was this guy, Jeremy Spencer, a guitar player. And if he didn't like a song, and he would just do a crappy job on it.
Right.
Or he'd bow out, and it's just like, oh, you know, I don't like your song, so yeah, I'm going to do a crappy job. That's not very good for anybody.
Who was the other guy from Fleetwood back that he did relatively well for a while, and I think he died relatively early. I think his name was Bob Welsh?
Peter Green. He was the founder of it.
Okay.
And Fleetwood Mac, in its founding, was actually a blues band. And, you know, this is something, as we're talking about Black History Month, to really understand where modern music, like rock and roll, came from.
Mm-hmm.
And it really came from Black American blues musicians like Willie Dixon and Muddy Waters. They were the kind of two most important ones. But there were lots of other Black American blues musicians. And they ended up coming in the Great Migration, coming up north, to many places, but particularly Chicago. And they had developed a certain kind of blues on acoustic guitars, Delta blues down in
yep.
Mississippi and all throughout there. And Muddy Waters got an electric, he couldn't afford an electric guitar, but he could afford a pickup, and he put it on his electric guitar. And, you know, you do that, it changes the sound, particularly when you make the amplifier really loud. So
right.
It gets distortion. And if you go back and you listen to those kinds of things, it's not just blues. That's the beginning of rock and roll. Willie Dixon. So some of the songs that he wrote were Superstitious is one of them, but also A Whole Lot of Love, Led Zeppelin songs. And it took him a while to get credit for it. But basically, the origins of heavy metal are the Black American blues musicians.
Mm-hmm.
And that's some of the stuff that we're going to be exploring in my 8 to 10 p.m. show this evening.
Very good. Yeah. Time travel here with you until 8 p.m. I'm here with Edward Buchert, and we're talking about blues musicians and Black History Month and time travel. What would you do if you were able to time travel? Where do you think you would want to go? The past? The future? You ever give it a little thought?
Wow, that's a terrific question, Chris. And I mean, I guess I've had these opportunities to kind of do that in a virtual way.
Mm-hmm.
My thought on traveling to the past is it's a lot rougher. It would be a lot rougher for us
yeah.
than used to our 21st century luxuries.
Very true. So assuming there would be no problems like the Back to the Future DeLorean losing, what do they lose? Gas, I think, in the Back to the Future 3. They run out of gas and it hasn't been invented yet.
Uh-huh.
So they have to get the steam engine to get Back to the Future to 1985 again. So assuming that all would go well, would there be a place that you'd want to visit in the past? Well, we don't know what the future is going to be, but future would be interesting, but you never know. You might get there, and it could be absolutely horrible. So
I've read a lot of science fiction, and so, yeah there's a lot of scary possibilities.
Yeah. You mentioned Philip K. Dick, so you're a big fan of Blade Runner, right?
I am.
Yeah, yeah. And the Man in the High Tower, right?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I love Blade Runner, and that's not really a future I think I'd want to visit. I don't know. Looks pretty bleak, right? In Blade Runner,
I think so.
Yeah,
You know, I guess I used to have an idea of a future where things would be really wonderful, and now I'm just sort of more skeptical. I see the 1984, the novel. Right now, basically Chinese people are living under a surveillance system that's far more powerful and ubiquitous than that.
Right.
And, but yeah, that I find really scary because as a practical matter, could that kind of system actually win?
It's possible.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think, just off the top of my head, I'm pretty happy not actually traveling into the past because I know how harsh things would be.
Yeah.
Like, just imagine living before there was electricity and not being able to turn on an electric light.
Right. Or penicillin. Electricity, penicillin. There's all kinds of huge advances without flight. I mean, you go back, well, a little over 100 years now, but it's like people were traveling by balloon in what, the 1700s, late 1700s?
Traveling, yeah, that would be, I mean, they weren't traveling by balloon as a practical matter. They were, balloon experimentation.
Right, right.
And like there was one thing in the Civil War, I know, where they put up a balloon, the Union put up a balloon to observe where the Confederates were coming from.
Right.
And that immediately gave away the position of the Union Army to the Confederates.
Yeah, the observation balloons. So now we have all the drones that can observe anywhere now, right?
Yeah, that kind of war technology. But another issue is just if you and I were to go back in time a couple hundred years ago, never mind thousands of years ago, there were all of these kind of pathogens that we don't have the immunity for anymore. So I think I've heard speculation that if pretty much any of us just did that, we'd die pretty quickly.
Yeah, no antibiotics. You get a scratch and then you go down. Yeah. I think I would like to, I think I would like to visit the 50s or 60s and see the birth of rock and roll, maybe.
Okay.
I think that would be kind of fun. But at the same time, it would just be, there is that innocence to it, but there's also a whole element of danger, like you said. I mean, it's not necessarily, there's always been evil, and there always will be, and there's always going to be progress and things that are set behind, but just different ways of thinking now, especially like in 2024, we have like the most sensitive Americans in the world now, I think, and just going back, even going back to the 90s or 80s, I think somebody that is a relatively young person would just be taken back by what they see in the 90s, even with some of the shows that were on TV and some of the movies and the way people talked. I mean, it wasn't that long ago. I mean, that was 30 years ago. But the only person that can say it wasn't that long ago is somebody that's lived for a while, and it's like more than a half a century old, so lived for a while. Saw some things happen so far. But yeah, what's funny to me is like seeing like Stanley Kubrick and, you have 2001 A Space Odyssey. And what progress did we make from 1968 to 2001? not a whole lot, you know. When it came to 2001, it's like, where are all these? Where's all the space travel? Where's the space baby that's going to save us? Where's the monolith?
Well, that's a curious thing, because I'd say, you know, looking at what 1968 and what 2001 turned out to be, the way computers became so much more powerful, and we had the internet in 2001.
Sure, yeah.
And that's something that, well, some people were anticipating that, but wow, that just really changed things. And I'd much rather have the internet developed as it was,
sure,
than having a moon base.
Yeah, but we weren't traveling to the moon. Yeah, we didn't have the Skylabs and all kinds of stuff flying around in 2001 that everybody was expecting. Nobody had the hover cars.
Flying cars, yep. Yeah. But, I mean, a flying car, I actually have, like, a bookmark folder on in my browser that it's called Flying Cars.
Yep.
And there's some web pages that have actual flying cars in them, but I use it as a metaphor for meaning an idea that's kind of been around for a while, and it seems like it'd be a wonderful idea, but it's just really a stupid idea when you really think about it because of all the compromises that you have to make. And I mean, you know, with a car, it's something you don't need to care too much about. You go on the gas and you step on the brake. And if the brake doesn't work, then you take it out to get repaired. But even if it doesn't work right then, you step off the gas and you come to a slow stop. But when you're in a plane, something doesn't work, you fall out of the sky.
Sure, yeah. What's funny is I fixed my brakes this morning. My buddy, I went down to his garage, and we ended up putting on some new rotors and some pads and my brakes. And, we're at the point now, too. I'm like, well, is this car going to come that we don't have to drive anymore? It just seems we're having the driving cars, and some people are all aboard for that. How do you feel about being chauffeured everywhere? Do you drive? Do you enjoy driving?
No, I don't enjoy driving. I do have a car, a 1997 Toyota Camry, and I use it when I need to go on long trips, like to visit my family in New York.
Sure.
And I use it when I need to really haul stuff, like potting soil and things like that from Home Depot, and when I go to the greenhouse to get my tomatoes and other plants in the spring.
Yep.
But in general, I prefer to walk around here, and I live in Somerville, and if I need to go to the grocery store, Market Basket, I take my backpack and I make it a walking trip. And that's where I substitute, like, you know, the 5 miles that you're... So kudos again for keeping up with that, Chris.
Thank you.
And what I find is to get a little more variety out of that, these backpack shopping trips. If there's an errand that I could run and it's anywhere between 4 miles and 10 miles, then I'll just take my backpack and go ahead and do that.
So no trips to, like, the White Mountains or go out to Colorado or anything? No long trips in the car? Never enjoyed them?
I've done those, and actually, I'm very proud to have traveled extensively for a human being. Mm-hmm. I've been to 23 different countries in the world.
Yeah, that's impressive. Yeah,
many of them in Asia, and basically on my own, not with a group of people or on any tour or anything.
Yep, yep.
And it's tremendously informed my life view and my view of what people are. But at this point in my life, I don't really think that that I need to or that I want to go off traveling in foreign countries.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the risks are kind of high, in the sense that what I would usually do is I'd come to fly into a country like Vietnam or Malaysia or Indonesia, having done some research beforehand, but certainly not speaking the language. And not having, you know, having some cash and, you know, changing that and having a guidebook from Lonely Planet.
Yeah.
But just kind of getting around that way myself, taking public transportation. But what I really loved doing was just wandering around the marketplaces and walking, It's a lot. It's more difficult to get lost in a foreign place if you're walking. It's certainly possible, but you know, if you get on public transport and a bus, you know, you could be dozens of miles away and you don't know where you are.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that's nice about when you go overseas is most places have great public transportation. I wouldn't say America is there yet.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, if you get to the cities, there's pretty good public transportation, but you live in the suburbs, it's like, it's pretty tough to get around still in the U.S. of A.
Yeah.
You know, especially when you get into those larger states, you know, and you get to the Midwest and stuff. I mean, you get on a bus, it's going to take you hours and hours to get there. So everybody has cars, you know? But
I was overhearing a conversation between two Tufts students today as I came back from the STS, Society, Technology, mm-hmm. Science, Technology, and Society Studies Department.
Mm-hmm.
Free lunch. Just Google STS, Tufts STS lunch.
Yep.
But they were talking about how close Seattle was. And one of them said, oh, it's only like 3 hours away by plane. And I think that's
not 3 hours away.
Right.
Right. That's a good ride. I mean, I think it's like five or six.
It's the complete opposite side of the country.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, go to California. It's going to be a, you know, 4 or 5 hour flight, I think. I mean, I went to Vegas. I think it was close to 3.5, 4.
Yeah, it's a big distance.
Yeah,
it's the continental United States. And so that's like 5,000 miles. But I think, so many ways the travel enriched me. One was by getting scammed in various ways multiple times.
Really?
One, pretty early on, I was in Thailand, in Bangkok, and I was kind of wandering around. I was at this kind of temple complex, and I struck up a conversation with a guy a little bit older than me.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the point of traveling, to strike up conversations with strangers.
Yeah, sure, why not?
He spoke English pretty well, and he explained that he worked for a bank and that he wanted to improve his language, and he could see I was a tourist, and he could take me around to the different places and kind of act as my guide. If I was, of course, I'd have to pay my own entrance fees and things like that. And it seemed like a good thing, so I did that. And we walked around a bit. We went to one kind of museum, had some chat and things, and we went to another temple like that. And then he was like, well, we can go on this boat ride here and go around Bangkok.
Okay.
And I asked him how much it was going to be, and he told me a certain price that seemed reasonable. So we did that, and then as we got to the end of the boat ride, somehow it came up that it was actually going to cost a whole lot more money. Rather than, say, being $5, it was actually like $80. And I didn't understand how that could happen, but he assured me, no, this is kind of what you agree. And I was just like, ugh. But I ended up paying the $80 to the boatman and everything.
Yeah.
And then we went off a bit, and then suddenly he needed to leave. And he needed to go to his work, which he hadn't explained before. In fact, it seemed like he had the whole day. And then I realized that he was actually going back to meet the guy at the boat, and they had a scam going where he would bring some gullible tourist, and they'd take him on a boat ride, and they'd have this, you know. But that's a common enough scam that you end up getting misunderstanding what the price was.
Yeah.
I also had some experiences. I went to the red light district in Bangkok, right? You're there, of course. It's Bangkok, red light district.
Yeah. See, if I time traveled, I would have told you not to talk to that guy.
Nah.
You know, or go to the red light, because I think something bad's going to happen with this one, too. What happened there?
Essentially, minding my own business. Drinking, watching things at the bar, and make some new lady friends or, you know, conversation there.
Okay.
I mean, I certainly wasn't looking, you know, a prostitute or anything, but just like, you know, this is the nightlife scene. There's music and everything, and some woman comes up and she wants to talk to you.
All right.
And have a good conversation, and then her boyfriend comes over.
Oh, boy.
And somehow they were trying to extort me for money, but I was just no, I think I just better leave and everything.
Yeah.
And then
not everybody's friendly. That's what you learn when you travel.
Yep.
Yeah.
And then there was another time in Indonesia, and I was in a park, a very nice national park. And there were these two guys who kind of came up to me. And again, we had a conversation. They kept asking me about my friends.
Okay.
And I first tried to explain that I was traveling by myself, but they didn't seem to understand that. And then they offered me some alcohol. And this was a little suspicious because they were Muslims, so they shouldn't be drinking alcohol.
Okay.
But on the other hand, this was still the, hey, I'm having a good time with people, and isn't this the point of travel?
Sure.
So I did that, and we all kind of drank from the cup. And actually nothing happened, but they sort of seemed surprised.
Really?
And afterwards, when I got back, I just realized that wasn't such a good idea, and maybe they were surprised because they were trying to drug me and take my money and stuff like that.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
All that said, yeah. I've had many wonderful experiences. I'm just bringing up, like, some bad ones.
Yeah.
This time I was in Hiroshima, Japan, and also at a festival, and I struck up a conversation with three people, a man and a woman and a friend of theirs, and then they took me out for dinner and drinks, and it was just great. Had a lot of fun.
Yeah, no, that's nice. Yeah, I went to Birmingham. I was in Oxford for the summer of 1990, and I wanted to go see Prince, so I went to go see Prince on my own, and I didn't have a ticket, and I was just a big fan of Prince at the time, and I got out there, and I ended up striking up a conversation with a kid on the bus. And at the time, I was probably, I don't know, 18, 19. I think I was 18. And this kid was probably 14, 15. He's like, hey, you want to meet my mom? I'm like, sure. I went and had, like, biscuits, and we had tea. And he's like, oh, he's going to be my pen pal. And, you know, we talked for a little bit and met his mom. And she was super nice to me. And I was just kind of waiting it out because I got there at, like, noon, and the tickets were going on sale at, like, 6 o'clock, and had a great time.
Nice.
Yeah, we had a lot of fun. And, so there is some kindness of strangers sometimes, but then other times it's like, I went out to New Orleans and I'm like, that's probably one of the most dangerous places I've ever been.
Mm.
And that's right here in the US of A. I mean, New Orleans is pretty crazy. And, you see a lot of bad stuff happen there.
One of the most profound experiences I had with that was in India, and walking around through this village with a lot of poor people.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's this different castes in India where it's, over many decades, this has become less so. But there used to be a very caste-oriented system with people up at the top, the priests, the Brahmins, and there being all of these rules that people couldn't marry between the castes. You had to marry somebody from your same caste. And a lot of the castes also had particular jobs that you were tied to.
Hmm.
And this idea of cleanliness versus not being uncleanly. And this whole thing goes up to there being this lowest caste of untouchables, and there's actually in fact an ethnic aspect to it. Originally the Aryans who invaded India had lighter skin, and they were the priest caste and the warrior castes, and so they were up at the highest. And then some other castes might be people who work with leather, and people who clean the sewers.
I'd rather work with leather. I don't want to clean the sewers.
Right, yeah.
I'd rather be one of the leather men.
But you wouldn't have a choice. You were born into it, and you couldn't, your children would have to be into that as well.
I'd just be like, oh, meet my wife, the sewer girl.
Yeah.
Awful.
Yeah.
I'd be like, meet my wife, the leather girl.
The leather girl. Yeah, that sounds a lot better. But I, just about all of the girls and women there have a nose ring that's made out of gold.
Mm.
So even poor people, I mean, if you're rich, you know, you have a lot more jewelry and decorations.
Yeah.
But even people without a lot of money still have a gold one. But this girl who was very beautiful, large eyes, but she was very poor. She wasn't even wearing a dress.
Okay.
It was something more like potato sack that was repurposed to that.
Oh.
And she was so poor that instead of having the gold nose ring, it was just a piece of copper wire that went through a hole in her nose and then twisted around.
It's probably like a fishing hook or something that they maybe used.
It was a piece of copper wire. I've got a picture of her somewhere. But it was sort of very sad, and yet she was beautiful, and she was kind of happy.
That's nice.
And when I went to India and a lot of other places, I brought a supply of sort of toy trinkets to go and give to people.
Yeah.
And they were things of the time, like this was the 1990s that I was in India, and I had a bunch of things I bought at the Boston Museum of Science. I remember some of them had pictures of the space shuttle, and they were these kinds of things with prismy lenses. So if you held it at one angle, you'd see the space shuttle on the launch pad, and if you held it at another, it'd be kind of going off with a little bit of the fire and the flame, and you held it that third, and then there'd be all. So I bought a bunch of things like that, and I'd give them to people.
Yep.
And in that same village, there was a young man, and I kind of traded him his toy, which was a top, you know, like a thing with a string, and you'd pull it.
Yeah, yeah.
And then it goes spinning, and it was
a gyroscope or something like that.
Something that's what we'd have in America, and we'd have like some. I saw an advertisement. Well, actually, I was bombarded with an advertisement for these things. They're metal tops, and the company sells them for anywhere for $40 to like $160 mm-hmm. each, and they'll sell you sets of them for hundreds of dollars, and it's just like, these tops
just that keep spinning.
They're spinning, and that's what it is. So expensive. But this particular top was actually the knob from an old piece of furniture.
Okay.
With the nail in it. It was the wooden knob there.
Okay.
And that's what the rest of the toy was. It was just a piece of string on there.
Yeah.
And then the thing that you pulled was actually just a piece of wood. It was like a thicker piece of a branch. And it was just this toy that was made out of like garbage and found the way stuff.
Sure.
But I love it because it's so authentic.
That's pretty cool, yeah. That's pretty cool. I don't know. If I was surrounded by garbage all the time when I was a kid, I'd be making up stuff like that all the time. And just be like, yeah, here's a hat I made out of, wood that was floating in the river. I would be making up stuff all the time, I think. And people would be like, get back to work.
That's a fascinating thing to think about. How to keep yourself entertained.
Yeah, and like you said, here's this beautiful girl, and she didn't probably know not having happiness. It was just like, it was just her way of life, so she didn't probably think of it. But then you a lot of people, especially, you get somewhere, and if you're from America and you're pretty much rich, I mean, even the poorest person is rich in compared to some of the countries that you visit, they don't know any better than to just live day to day and be happy. And
I've spent a lot of time researching how hunter-gatherers live their lives, and many people have this idea, like Thomas Hobbes, the English philosopher and thinker. I kind of thought that people who lived outside of civilization had short, nasty, brutish lives, and that everything was a constant struggle for survival.
Mm.
And I think from my studies of this, there are certain very high-pressure times, but being a hunter-gatherer in Africa, which is where for certainly hundreds of thousands of years as we became modern human beings, and for millions before we really were true human beings, how we lived. And I don't think it was that constant struggle for survival. Where we lived, it was so comfortable temperature-wise year-round that humans didn't have to wear clothes.
Yeah.
And the food was relatively abundant. When anthropologists go back and look at hunter-gatherer societies, they're finding people are spending maybe about 4 hours a day on the necessities of life, like getting food.
Yeah.
There's a lot of time that people are hanging out In general, good times.
Yeah.
Well, this is also comes up with, you know, how did we become creatures who are so focused on sex, which, you know, compared to other creatures, modern human beings spend an inordinate amount of time on things related to sex, like looking good and so many things.
Get the nice Fendi bag, you know, good makeup, you know, nice new hat, Devo hat.
But I think, I think there was a lot, though, of that going on in more primitive societies.
Yeah.
And that could have been, you know, a lot of fun if you were growing up there.
Yeah.
Of course, that means a lot of fun. I mean, being pretty much human beings, I understand, began having sex as soon as they were able to.
Yeah.
So a lot of
some
the kind
of them just didn't stop. They just kept going.
Well, some of the moralities of that, I mean, you know, being 13 and being 14 and having sex, I mean, there's a lot of crazy stuff with that going on. But overall, my studies of hunter-gatherer societies say that life wasn't really so bad. It wasn't the constant struggle for survival. There was a lot of hanging out and a lot of recreation.
Yeah.
And when you compare what life was like for people living during the Industrial Revolution.
Ugh. Yeah.
I mean, 12, 14 hours a day.
Yeah, fingers are getting lopped off left and right. It's like they'd have all the kids like putting their fingers through things because, you know, they had the smallest fingers. Things were going on, getting lopped off left and right in Industrial Revolution is awful.
And if you gave me the choice between being an Australian Aborigine and doing the things that when the English came over and they colonized Australia, they had a terribly low opinion of the lifestyle, that the people were eating bugs and all of that. And yet, I think when you really look at what the details of that were, compared to being a factory worker in Britain during the Industrial Revolution, really that Dickinson kind of life.
Yeah.
Oh man, what a horror
I'd
that would be!
I'd rather eat bugs than lose a couple of fingers.
Have you ever eaten bugs?
Sure, yeah, I've eaten a bug or two. Yeah, delicious. No, I've eaten a bug or two. You know.
Tufts had an event here. The Environmental Studies Department sponsored it, and it was essentially a catered insect dinner.
Oh, geez.
They had a company who specializes in this kind of stuff, and a chef.
Yeah.
And they prepared probably about 8 different kinds of food.
Yeah.
And it was a really fun experience, especially to take pictures and to send them to people afterwards.
Yeah. That's like going on Fear Factor. Yeah, there was a game dinner once that I went to, and I had never experienced like anything like that before. You know, usually, you know, being a boy of the 70s, pretty much, you know, it was hot dogs and hamburger nights and Prince Spaghetti Day and, you know, Chinese food every now and then, you know, order out pizzas. But so I went to a dinner, and they all shot everything and killed it, and then you ate it. So everybody that was there was part of the Rod and Gun Club, and they had a game dinner. So they served beaver, they served bear, they served venison, they served turtle soup. So in one night, I ate like 12 things I'd never eaten before, and probably never will again. But it was interesting enough. I think if I were on Survivor, one of the hardest challenges for me would be the food challenge. Even though I'm a big guy and I love food, I think I can't get past my mind. Like they had like a big fish eye on the last Survivor, and just the guy just went in like a golf ball and just chowed down on it. And I'm like, oh, no, not for me. It's too squeamish there. And I think that's the Englishman in me from being from generations of, you know, English and squeamish and using things with, you know, forks and knives and cutlery all the time.
Well,
you know?
Every culture has these things that other cultures look at and say that that they look crazy. There's a lot of English food that I think is kind of strange, right? Blood pudding.
Yes.
And but I think when it comes to traveling, one of the wonderful things is trying such a wide variety of food. And I've been very open-minded about that. My parents were very good in retrospect with saying you don't have to eat like a full portion, but you should at least try something when you get different opportunities.
Sure, somebody's offering it to you, too.
So yeah.
Some cultures, it's considered an insult if they're giving you something and you don't try it.
Yep.
Yeah.
So I would try any food that people eat in a culture for real, but I wouldn't go and try Survivor type of gross out food that people don't normally eat.
Yeah. Well, a lot of people eat grubs and things like that.
Yeah.
Locusts, right? Locust is a big one.
Yeah, and in fact, if you buy protein powder, like what weightlifters, a lot of those brands are essentially crickets, ground up crickets.
Yeah, yeah.
Just read the label. But but that, one of the things at the Tufts Bug Dinner was talking about how these are a source of protein that's very economical and good for the earth.
We should have a bug dinner here at WMFO.
Well, we're not allowed to bring food into the studio.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, we can have it outside and we can have it downstairs maybe. Or out in the lobby. It's like, we'll see how many people show. I think we could fit everybody into the lobby for the amount of people that want to come into the bug dinner. But yeah. No, I had a couple of bugs in my time. You know, not on purpose, but yeah. Yeah, beetle all of a sudden ended up in like the cereal or something.
In fact, there's a particular FDA allowed percentage of number of bug parts in any cereal and things like flour, and that's just the way it is.
Yeah.
I think if you grow your own food, like I do, you get more used to the idea of some part of it was eaten by a bug and you just cut that away or you wash it or whatever.
Yeah.
I don't have a problem. I mean, if you're growing your own food, then you aren't going to get a lot of perfect food.
Yeah, just swallow it quick. You don't have to chew. You know?
The kinds of things that, let's see, in Korea, I saw this thing in many restaurant windows that was kind of white and... Well, I was intrigued enough to try it, and I found out it was kind of pork ears with a lot of pork skin.
Yeah.
And it was really gross.
Was it hairy?
No. That was the thing. It was kind of so smooth and fatty.
Yep.
And once I realized that it was just really skin that had been cooked and boiled, I couldn't eat it. And then there was another in Japan. I tried some whale meat.
And how was that?
It was gross. It was like liver to me, like beef liver, and I just wouldn't do it. And yeah, I'm not proud of that, but at least I've done that. In Vietnam, you know, there's places, snakes are kind of popular, and you can go along, and the people who are the snake chefs will have cages of the snakes.
Yeah.
And you can pick which one that you want.
Yeah, and they have to get rid of the venom out of the snakes, too, don't they?
I think maybe they just chop off the head.
Yeah. That's one way to do it. So, yeah.
I've got a bottle of snake wine that I bought in...
Really?
It's got the kind of cobra in it. It's inside the top of the jar. And then there's a bunch of other, like, nuts and other things at the bottom where the tail is all coiled.
How do you make the snake wine? How do they make that?
I'm not sure. I mean, I guess I can say that they somehow got the snake in the bottle and they put the other stuff and then the wine that's in there. Maybe there must be some traces of the snake blood, perhaps.
Yeah.
You ever have blood puddings?
When I was in England. Yeah, nothing special. I tried it, and I was just like, no, not for me. Usually I'll try it, and then I'll just be like, no, not for me.
What are some gross foods that you've eaten?
Cauliflower.
Really?
Yeah, I don't like cauliflower.
Oh, my goodness.
I had a cauliflower floret, like, fly out of my nostril one night. And I love peas now, but once my mother had to suck a pea out my nose when I was a baby. I was choking, and I stuck a pea right up my nose. She had to get a straw and suck it out.
Oh, my goodness.
So I thank my mama every day for saving my life.
Yeah.
Yeah, I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for mama. Yeah, in a lot of ways. So, I think things that I didn't like as a kid, I like more as an adult now, most things. Like I was saying, you know, as a kid, it's like most people don't have much of a palate, you know, tuna and pizza and... you know, pasta and cheap things when you were a kid, and, you know, going to college, same thing. It's like a tin of tuna. And a tin of tuna, of course, has roaches and roach hairs and all that stuff in it, and chocolate, too. Chocolate has a lot of little parts in it, and there's a certain percentage that is allowed to pass for you to get a Hershey bar and still have a little bit of bug in it, right? But, yeah, I think... broccoli, I used to hate as a kid. I love it now. I eat it all the time.
Olives?
Yeah. I don't like olives. I've never liked olives. Yeah, never been a big olive fan. I like olive oil. but, yeah, I've never been a big olive fan. Usually, like, the vegetables, like, I can do a big salad, but I've always been more of a fan of the yellow vegetables, like the squash. And butternut squash, the orange, you know. Not so big fan of the greens, but I'll eat them. You know, I like broccoli, but I'm not a big fan of, like, Brussels sprouts or any of that stuff. Liver I don't like.
Yeah, that's awful. Nuts. How about chicken livers? Do you feel differently about them?
No, don't like them. Yeah, don't like them. But, yeah, I think when it comes to different tastes, there's not a whole lot of things that I really want to try. It's like I know what I like at this point, and I can get by with it. I did go vegan for about 3 months,
mm-hmm.
and it was fine. I didn't think it was that hard to do. I didn't particularly have a great time doing it, but I did it. And, you know, after I'm like, no, you know, I like chicken and beef too much, you know. And it's like, as long as you're not overdoing it, you're going to live a ripe age, you know.
I think one simple weight loss, well, it's kind of a lifestyle change too, but it works well. If you become vegetarian or just looking at any vegetables that you eat as not worrying about it. Mm-hmm. I had a girlfriend before I knew her. Apparently, she was pretty overweight. And she just became a vegetarian, not because she felt so much compassion for the animals, but just because she wanted to lose weight.
Mm-hmm.
And essentially this rule of if you're eating vegetables or fruits and they're whole, they're not processed, like, you know, not applesauce with added sugar and everything
right.
that. Yep. But if you're just eating whole foods like that, you can eat as much of them as you want.
Right.
And yeah. I have this soup that I've been making for probably about 8 months now.
Mm-hmm.
And when I started getting vegetables from my garden, they were a key part of it. But you take a bunch of vegetables like squash, broccoli.
Cabbage.
Cabbage, yes, yep. Different kinds of cabbage. And cut them up and boil them. And mm-hmm. Then carrots, too, and celery.
Yeah, I love carrots. I love carrots a lot.
And
raw or cooked.
And I just boil up a whole bunch of them, and then I take a package of ramen noodles,
mm-hmm.
and I add some of the sort of soup water there, the vegetable, in a big bowl. I dump all those vegetables in there, and I put some cheese on top, and then I microwave that. So I haven't actually boiled the ramen noodles, but they're in with some of the vegetable liquid and then all those vegetables. And on my microwave oven, it takes about 4.5 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And the ramen end up getting cooked enough so that they're noodles. They're still a bit al dente.
Yep.
But it's an enormous bowl of boiled vegetables.
Yeah. That's good for you.
It is. And you kind of feel, at least I feel, pretty stuffed after I have it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not that kind of thing that I get when I have a meal with meat or with a lot of fat in it, like Thanksgiving dinner.
Yeah, and you get all,
like, lazy. Yeah. Right. It's like time for a nap.
Yeah.
You feel at the end like, oh, I'm stuffed. And then like 15 minutes later, it's like, oh, yeah, now I'm, you know, all active again.
Yeah, I'll tell you, the walking every day, I've got much more energy. And I've been doing it. I also added for this month of February, I'm going to make sure I'm having at least a gallon of water. And I'm making sure I'm having salad every day. So I'm making these big bowls. So yesterday and today I made like big bowls. And what you have to be careful with there is you can't do the Parmesan peppercorn. You know, you got to do something like a little, you know, oil and vinegar. And that's about it. You know, you can't really you know, throw a bunch of Ken's marinade on there. You know, you got to pretty much eat them raw, you know. But I think it helps a whole lot. And like you said, you know, you get filled up from the salad and, you know, you don't feel lethargic
you know,
throughout your day.
That's a good point that you're making. One of the things I've been doing with this boiled vegetable soup is to actually use some salad dressings on it after I drink some of the liquid, and then I'm left with all those. But I think the boiled vegetable, the part about that is it's the water is adding the mass to it. So it really, it's going into your stomach and you're feeling full and you're being satisfied. I think to just to contrast that kind of approach with it, where people who want to lose weight by eating less food but stick with their regular diet, and you have something like, okay, let's look at a McDonald's meal proportion with these calories. And it's like, you know, one small burger or something and half the French fries, and you eat an amount of food like that and you're hungry.
Yeah.
And that's going to be the problem. And, you know,
plus
a lot of people.
Crap food.
And, yeah. Without any fiber.
Yeah.
So that kind of like boiled vegetables or just eating a lot of vegetables. It's got all those fibers and it's filling you up and it's not having a lot of calories. So I'd advocate for that.
We should do a PSA for fresh vegetables and fruits. There's got to be one in there.
Oh, yeah. We've got plenty of. Well, we've got, yes, the fresh. And
we got that one with all the apple, banana, cherries. What's D? Donuts?
Donuts, yeah.
little chocolate donuts.
Yeah, let's go through the book. Yes. Oh, I had this series. I had first came the dried fruit PSA.
Yes.
And then came the sequel, the fresh fruit PSA.
Mm-hmm.
But I'll read the dried fruits one because I'm more. I am. My go-to snack, I eat probably about 10 pieces of dried apple a day.
Oh, that's good. I like dried apple.
Yeah.
Yeah. My favorite's apricot.
Yeah. Bingo! That's the other one I have.
Yeah.
Now, when I say pieces, I mean I kind of tear up the pieces. I get them from Trader Joe's. But yeah, it's a bunch. And I used to like have some candy or chew gum or something like that. And now it's just I take the piece of dried fruit and I maybe put it in my mouth and I chew it around, enjoy the flavor. And then when it gets to, then I chomp down. And yeah, that's a wonderful snack. So, you know, if you're looking for some sweet, great tasting snacks that are also healthy for you, you should consider eating dried fruits. Dried figs, apples, cherries, bananas, apricots, peaches, pears, pineapples, raisins, cranberries, prunes, blueberries, mangoes, and oh, so many other fruits are both tasty and good for you. Many dried fruits are also an excellent natural source of cancer-fighting dietary fiber. Read the labels to understand which brands have added sugars, preservatives, and other ingredients. But no matter what, eating pretty much any kind of fruit is going to be better for you than candy or a processed snack. This has been a public service message from all of us fruits and nuts here at WMFO in Medford. Yes, we are Tufts Educational Radio.
Very good. Happy Groundhog Day, everybody. So, I don't know if you heard, Edward, but we have an early spring coming, so there's going to be more time for walking and hiking and gardening.
I hope it's a legitimate early spring instead of these kind of polar vortex stuff that screw around with the plants, because it comes like February or something, it's all nice and warm, and they say, okay, it's time to get ready to start blooming, and then we get like these Arctic cold things and they kill all that, and we don't have blossoms in the spring when it finally comes around for real.
There's one thing that I do like about the winter, though, and that's having a nice blanket on the couch sometimes on a nice quiet night. I think that's what I'm going to do tonight, is just throw in a movie, put on a blanket, maybe have a little popcorn, a little snack, you know.
While you're listening to Tears of the Gods,
Yeah. Yeah.
Another thing maybe to try, you know, on these cold winter days is to take the clothes that you're going to wear before you go out on your 5 miles and put them over the radiator, if you have that kind of radiator at home.
I've actually, I've been taking, because I have a down jacket and it just gets soaked because I layer myself.
Yeah.
So I'm really sweating there. But yeah, so I'm taking that and making sure I'm washing that out because it's getting cut. But putting it right over the dry air and taking care of it that way. But this has been Time Travel 2.0. I don't know where I'm going to land next week, but I've enjoyed our time here, Edward. It was a lot of fun.
Thank you for having me, Chris.
And hopefully we can do it again in the coming season here in WMFO Spring 2024. I'll see you guys next week, but stick around for Tears of the Gods with Edward. WMFO in Medford, Massachusetts.